The leader of all the Mayavadi sannyasis present was named Prakashananda Saraswati, and after standing up, he addressed Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as follows with great respect. Purport, as Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu showed respect to all the Mayavadi sannyasis, similarly, the leader of the Mayavadi sannyasis, Prakashananda, also showed his respects to the Lord. So, this is preaching. Prabhupada explains that the preaching formula of Prabodhananda Saraswati, different personality, is that when you greet people, you flatter them and you tell them how wonderful they are. Is even though they may be rascals or fools, still you approach them with respect and you say that you're a great learned person, you're a great sadhu, you have so many good qualities. Now just please hear about the glories of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So here, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they're addressed here as the chief of the Mayavadi sannyasis. It's kind of like Prahlad Maharaj when he addresses his father. He says, "Oh, best among the demons." In the sense that these Mayavadis are completely offensive in respect to the personal aspect of, in other words, they deny the personality of Krishna. They say that it's something mundane. Uh-oh. I'm under scrutiny now. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is showing a perfect example of how to preach. He takes the most humble position. He sits in the shoe with the shoes where people wash their feet. And when they say, "Oh, why won't you sit with us?" he basically responded that, "Well, I'm a lower order of sannyasi. I mean, I can't sit with such exalted persons." So immediately, of course, that had the effect that they wanted him to sit with them even more, and they immediately gained more respect for him by his behavior because he behaved so nicely. And here we see that Prakashananda, he's following suit. He's showing respect in response. So in civilized cultural situations, this is the way people behave. There is an offering of humility. And then when they do that, it isn't that the response is, "Oh, he must be a fool or a less intelligent or a less qualified person, so I can lord it over him more." No, it's the opposite response, that he's behaved very humbly. That means he's a civilized, cultured person. Let me also respond in kind. I'm going to go back a little bit, though, if it's all right, because I wanted to speak about Text 61 a bit more. We see in Text 60 how Lord Chaitanya exhibited his mystic power by illuminating an effulgence that was so brilliant. When the Mayavadi sannyasis saw it, they were just amazed. And, of course, for Lord Chaitanya, this is not extraordinary, but so far as their experience goes, it was quite extraordinary. And it says in the translation of Text 61, when the sannyasis saw the brilliant illumination of the body of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, their minds were attracted, and they all immediately gave up their sitting places and stood in respect. So they respect effulgence. The Mayavadis are very respectful of effulgence. So in a sense, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used this perfect tactic. He knew that this is the thing that they're after, so he exhibited it. And they were very, not only attracted, but they were very impressed. So, in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's account, this comes from the introduction to TLC. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, it's an excerpt from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, His Life and Precepts. It gives a little summary of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's travels and how he came to Benares, which I'm going to read, and then he talks about this particular encounter with Prakashananda Saraswati. Chaitanya returned to Puri through Shantipur, where he again met his dear mother. After a short stay at Puri, he left for Vrindavan. This time he was accompanied by one Balabhadra Bhattacharya. He visited Vrindavan and came down to Prayag, Allahabad, converting a large number of Mohammedans to Vaishnavism by argument from the Quran. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is a great scholar, and he was able to convince them on the basis of Quran. The descendants of those converts are still known as Patana Vaishnavas. Rupa Goswami met him at Allahabad. Chaitanya trained him up in spirituality in 10 days and directed him to go to Vrindavan on missions. His first mission was to write theological works explaining scientifically pure bhakti and prema. The second mission was to revive the places where Krishna Chandra had, in the end of Dwapara Yuga, exhibited his spiritual leela pastimes for the benefit of the religious world. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is a great writer. I mean, he's summarizing something in a few sentences in such a refined and poetic way for the benefit of the religious world. It's just nice writing. I mean, the thing about the writing of these great acharyas is that it isn't just that they explain spiritual topics so brilliantly, but their language is full of poetic ornaments and just fantastic writing. Being inspired by the Supersoul, they can write better than anyone. So this is the perfection of writing. So he says, Rupa Goswami left the Allahabad for Vrindavan, and Mahaprabhu came down to Benares. There he resided in the house of Chandrasekhar and accepted his daily bhiksha meal in the house of Tapana Mishra. Here it was that Sanatana Goswami joined him and took instruction for 2 months in spiritual matters. The biographers, especially Krishnadas Kaviraj, have given us details of Chaitanya's teachings to Rupa and Sanatana. Krishnadas was not a contemporary writer, but he gathered his information from the Goswamis themselves, the direct disciples of Mahaprabhu. Jiva Goswami, who was the nephew of Sanatana and Rupa, and who has left us his invaluable work, the Shatsandharva, has philosophized on the precepts of his great leader. We have gathered and summarized the precepts of Chaitanya from the books of those great writers. While at Benares, Chaitanya had an interview with the learned sannyasis of that town in the house of a Maratha Brahmana who had invited all the sannyasis for entertainment. Now, it's interesting. He says he's invited them for entertainment. It's kind of not quite the right attitude, it would seem, but anyway, that was at least in those days, having saintly persons in your home, it could be classified as entertainment, but it was, you know, it's kind of a very high form of entertainment, elevated entertainment. At this interview, Chaitanya showed a miracle which attracted all the sannyasis to him. Then ensued reciprocal conversation. The sannyasis were headed by their most learned leader, Prakashananda Saraswati. After a short controversy, they submitted to Mahaprabhu and admitted that they had been misled by the commentaries of Shankaracharya. Now here's the part that I like. Well, I like all of it, but this is really nice. He says, it was impossible even for learned scholars to oppose Chaitanya for a long time, for there was some spell in him which touched their hearts and made them weep for their spiritual improvement. So he's describing the effect that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had on these hard-hearted. They're known for being hard-hearted because they deny the personality of Godhead. So he says there was a spell in him. So it wasn't so much what he said, but his presence was so overwhelming and so blissful and so full of affection that when his presence, they melted. So it says that it touched their hearts and made them weep for their spiritual improvement. The sannyasis of Benares soon fell at the feet of Chaitanya and asked for his grace, kripa. Chaitanya then preached pure bhakti and instilled into their hearts spiritual love for Krishna, which obliged them to give up sectarian feelings. The whole population of Benares on this wonderful conversion of the sannyasis turned Vaishnavas, and they made a master sankirtan with their new lord. After sending Sanatana to Vrindavan, Mahaprabhu went to Puri again through the jungles with his comrade Balabhadra. Balabhadra reported that Mahaprabhu had shown a good many miracles on his way to Puri, such as making tigers and elephants dance on hearing the name of Krishna. So as he was traveling through the Jharkhand forest, we know the story that he actually was engaging the animals of the forest animals in Sankirtan. I have a great old print in my house. It's I don't remember where I got it, but it's when I lived in India, and there's this print that shows Lord Chaitanya dancing and chanting with the animals. And one of the tigers is standing on his hind legs like this, and coming out of his mouth is, like, in Sanskrit, is the Maha Mantra floating up into the air. Really great picture. So, and in one purport to this song, one of the songs of Narottam Das, Prabhupada comments that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had so much power that he could get the animals to chant. He says, we may not be able to do that, but at least we should try to get the human beings to do so. So, similar challenge, I guess, yeah. All right, I'll read the purport to text 61, and I apologize if you've already been over this purport, but it's the one I prepared for. So, to draw the attention of common men, sometimes saintly persons, acharyas, and teachers exhibit extraordinary opulences. This is necessary to attract the attention of fools. But a saintly person should not misuse such power for personal sense gratification, like false saints who declare themselves to be God. Even a magician can exhibit extraordinary feats that are not understandable to common men, but this does not mean that the magician is God. It is a most sinful activity to attract attention by exhibiting mystic powers and then to utilize this opportunity to declare oneself to be God. A real saintly person never declares himself to be God, but always places himself in the position of a servant of God. For a servant of God, there is no need to exhibit mystic powers, and he does not like to do so. But on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, a humble servant of God performs his activities in such a wonderful way that no common man can dare try to act like him. Yet, a saintly person never takes credit for such actions because he knows very well that when wonderful things are done on his behalf by the grace of the Supreme Lord, all credit goes to the master and not to the servant. So there's a section in the Pastimes of Haridas Thakur in which Haridas Thakur was doing his chanting in the confines of a cave or a cave-like dwelling. And people used to come and visit him there to get his darshan. And it turned out that there was a very powerful smell, so acrid and so strong that nobody could tolerate it. And so they were pleading with him that he should leave the cave and live somewhere else. So Haridas was surprised because he hadn't noticed anything. He was so absorbed in his chanting that even though there was this powerful smell, he hadn't really noticed it. But he said, since you are all suffering and unable to tolerate the burning of the poison, I will leave tomorrow for another place. If there is a snake in this cave and it doesn't leave by tomorrow, then I'll leave and go to some other place. Don't worry. Let us all chant Krishna's names. So, at that point, as they were chanting with Haridas Thakur, this enormous snake started slithering out of the cage. And there's a description. The large, wonderful snake looked most fearful, yet it was also very beautiful, being colored yellow, blue, and white. As the brahmanas saw the brilliant jewel adorning its head, they fearfully remembered Krishna. So, fearfully remembering means they were chanting, but they were in some anxiety. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. After the snake left that place, the brahmanas were overjoyed to find that the burning sensation was gone. They all appreciated Haridas's marvelous potency and developed great devotion for him. So the thing is that these brahmanas, they didn't think he was all that. I mean, they had respected him before, but, you know, they thought, well, but after all, he is a Muslim. So he's not a Brahmin. He's not one of us. But still, he chants all the time. So, you know, we're impressed. But when they saw that, then they really became impressed. They thought that it was a display of his mystic abilities. So the comment is that they're classified more on the level of not brahmanas but dvija bandhus, or unqualified descendants of brahmanas, because they were only impressed by the powers that he exhibited rather than by the qualities that he was emanating, you know, every moment of his life. So there are many examples of miraculous displays in the lives of great devotees. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu performed some extraordinary pastimes. Jesus Christ walked on the water and cured the sick and so many things. People who were blind were made to be able to see. Ramanuja, Lord Buddha, other great saints, they've all exhibited sometimes miraculous behavior. In fact, when Lord Buddha was asked about miracles and mystic power, he said there are three kinds of miraculous powers. One is the power to appear as many persons, to pass through walls, to fly through the air, walk on water. He said these are physical actions that ordinary people cannot perform. Then another power to read other people's minds. So these are all listed in the different siddhis, yogic siddhis. The third is the power to be able to guide people according to their mental development for their own good, using suitable methods appropriate for each person. So basically he summarized that this was the only one that a real saintly person should ever utilize. He said the others are kind of low grade in comparison, but this is the important one, to try to help other people become. Of course, Lord Buddha was teaching a slightly different philosophy, but the idea is to lead people towards enlightenment. That was important, not these other things. They're just basically some kind of tricks, like a magician performs tricks. So these are a kind of magic trick that people are able to do through austerity. They gain some mystic power. So this was the one that he considered to be important. And Prabhupada talks a little bit about mystic power. He says, so bhukti, mukti, that is also desire. Bhukti, mukti, and siddhi kami, yogis, astanga yoga, and ashta siddhi, anima, lagima, prapti siddhi, ishita, vashita, like that. Anima, anu, you can become very small. Actually, those who are in perfectional yoga, they can become like that, smaller than the smallest. So anima, lagima, you can become lighter than the lightest. You can fly in the air. They go by touching the beam of sun, moon, they can go. They are trying to go to the moon planet by artificial material means, but those who are yogis, they can catch up the beam of the moon and go. Mahima, you can become very big, heavy. Mahima, just like Hanuman, he jumped over the ocean. That means he assumed a big body so that one leg here, one leg there, he can jump. That is called Mahima Siddhi. Prapti, you can get anything you like at any time. Prapti Siddhi. So many things. Sometimes they do not like the devotees because the devotees, within 4 years, 5 years, the whole world should be chanting Hare Krishna mantra. That is not magic. But if he can jump over a river, that is magic. So he's being sarcastic. That is magic. The other side of the magic, they have no eyes to see. In fact, actually, Prabhupada was once asked, can you show a miracle? And Prabhupada said, and pointed to his disciples and said, here's the miracle. Because these people were all doing all kinds of nonsense. And now they're, you know, following this process. So he said that was the miracle. But he says here they have no eyes to see that miracle. So the yoga siddhi, that is magic. But devotee can show better magic, but they do not bother their time for yoga practice. That is bhakta, because he's under the care of the supreme magician, Krishna. So if there is need of magic, Krishna will show. Why he should bother? Just like a small child is dependent on his father. Father is a rich man, so he says to his father, Father, I want this. That is very costly. So he doesn't require to get the money. The Father is there. He'll get the money. All right, take it. So that is the facility for the devotees. The devotee is under the care of Yogeshwara. Yatra Yogeshwara Hari. If you can catch up the hand of Yogeshwara Hari, then you can show wonderful magic, which no magician, no yogis can display. That is the position of devotee. They do not care for practicing yoga to show some magical feats. Neither they require it. Neither they want it. Because devotee's position is aslishyava padaratang pinastu mang adarshanang marmahatang korotu va. Whatever you like, you can do. That's all. He has no desire. So, and, you know, Prabhupada summarizing this, I mean, they're very wonderful, these siddhis, but the devotee doesn't really have much interest in them. Very occasionally, a devotee will use some siddhi, as Prabhupada says, to attract fools in the previous purport. So in other words, people that are not very intelligent, they tend to go for these gurus that can produce gold or some kind of ashes, and then they're impressed. Yeah, that's a great story, actually, that Maharaj just mentioned, because not everybody could hear, that when Vrindavan, Prabhupada wanted to, well, he didn't want, but they had a life member who was a magician, and he wanted to show his magic show for Prabhupada's entertainment. So then Prabhupada sent for the Gurukula students, and they all came down. So this magician began to do all these tricks, and he was pulling coins out of Prabhupada's ear and doing all these. And some of the devotees were thinking, this isn't really appropriate, you know, that he's pulling coins from Prabhupada's ears. But Prabhupada was laughing. He was enjoying it. So at the end of the show, he asked the magician if he could make birth, death, old age, and disease disappear. Do you know that trick? He said. The magician says, no, I don't know that one. Prabhupada says, but I know that. So that's the ultimate magic. So this is the ultimate mysticism, devotional mysticism, that you can alter a person's heart and make them, you know, lovers of God. This is something extraordinary, really extraordinary. And it's a permanent, it's not temporary, it's permanent. So there's some other quotes I have here that lately, a lot of my classes have been like reading different things that Prabhupada said and then briefly commenting on them. Some people might think that that's sort of cheating. And it probably is, but I like it, so you'll have to put up with it. I'd rather hear what Prabhupada has to say mostly. So sometimes to mitigate distresses in this forest, the Prabhupada's talking about the forest of the material world. There's a chapter in the fifth canto about the nature of the material forest and the whole material world, in other words. He says the conditioned soul receives cheap blessings from atheists. He then loses all intelligence in their association. This is exactly like jumping in a shallow river. As a result, one simply breaks his head. He is not able to mitigate his sufferings from the heat, and in both ways he suffers. So you're suffering from heat, you jump in a shallow river and you break your head. So you get the blessings of people that are not qualified to give them. It doesn't do you any good. In fact, it can do you harm even. So it says, the misguided conditioned soul also approaches the so-called sadhus and swamis who preach against the principles of the Vedas. He does not receive benefit from them either in the present or in the future. And then he writes a purport. He says, cheaters are always there to manufacture their own way of spiritual realization. To get some material benefit, the conditioned soul approaches these pseudo-sannyasis and yogis for cheap blessings, but he does not receive any benefit from them, either spiritual or material. In this age, there are many cheaters who show some jugglery and magic. They even create gold to amaze their followers, and their followers accept them as God. This kind of cheating is very prominent in Kali Yuga. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes the real guru in this way, Sangsara Dhavana Lila Loka Tranaya Karunya Ganaganatam praptasya kalyana kunanavasya vande guru shri charanaravindam. One should approach a guru who can extinguish the blazing fire of this material world, the struggle for existence. People want to be cheated, and therefore they go to yogis and swamis who play tricks. This is a great sentence. But tricks do not mitigate the miseries of material life. So no matter how wonderful a person's tricks are, it doesn't do anything about the miseries of material existence. So if he is able, if being able to manufacture gold is a criterion for becoming God, then why not accept Krishna, the proprietor of the entire universe, wherein there are countless tons of gold? As mentioned before, the color of gold is compared to the will of the wisp or yellow stool. Therefore, one should not be allured by gold manufacturing gurus, but should sincerely approach a devotee like Jada Bharat. Jada Bharat. Yeah. Jada Bharat instructed Rahugana Maharaj so well that the king was relieved from the bodily conception. One cannot become happy by accepting a false guru. A guru should be accepted as advised in Srimad Bhagavatam. Tasmat gurum prapadyeta kigyasu shreya uttamam. One should approach a bona fide guru to inquire about the highest benefit of life. Such a guru is described as follows. Shabde pare chanishnatam. Such a guru does not manufacture gold or juggle words. He is well versed in the conclusions of Vedic knowledge. Vedaischa sarvair ahang eva vedyo. He is freed from all material contamination and is fully engaged in Krishna's service. If one is able to obtain the dust of the lotus feet of such a guru, his life becomes successful. Otherwise, he is baffled both in this life and in the next. So that's from the 5th canto, 14th chapter. So, essentially, this is the this theme. In fact, as I was looking through the Vedabase, this theme about false gurus who, through mystic power or some type of magical demonstration, they're able to attract the minds of people that don't know much about spiritual life, and basically they're cheating them. And therefore, we have in Krishna's pastimes, for instance, where there was a person. Does anybody remember the name of this person who was pretending to be him? He had four arms. Two arms were fake, and two were real. Huh? Yes, Poundraka was. He actually convinced himself that he was God, and so he was declaring it everywhere that he was the personality of Godhead. So Krishna, it almost sounds a little cruel. I mean, this person was delusional, and. Poundraka was delusional, and but Krishna's response was quite strong. He accosted him on a battlefield and told him to give up this nonsense, and when Poundraka didn't, he removed his head. So these things are taken quite seriously. I know at one time, some of you may remember, I'm sure Maharaj remembers, remember this so-called avatar Guru Maharaji that was 13 years old, he was supposed to be God? Yeah. Well, this is kind of, it's a little bit humorous, but there was a tape, a conversation that the devotees had with Prabhupada. They were telling him a little bit about this so-called avatar. So Prabhupada started to tell about Poundraka and how Krishna had killed Poundraka. And then at one point in the conversation, he said about Guru Maharaja, he said he should be killed. Now, of course, he wasn't saying that we should go out and kill him. He was saying a person who acts like that should be killed, because that's Krishna's example. If a person pretends to be God, that's actually a very serious offense, and they should be stopped. Well, there was going to be a big rally for Guru Maharaji in Houston, at the Houston Astrodome. So this one devotee in Dallas, I won't mention his name because I don't want to. But anyway, he got the idea that Prabhupada was actually wanted him to be killed. So he was making elaborate plans to go there and assassinate Guru Maharaj. It took us about 4 hours to convince him that it might not be a good idea. But anyway, these days people get away with it, you know, pretending to be God. There's no specific laws against it anymore. But there are still such persons who are claiming to be God, no doubt. But I was thinking about, he's still around. Yeah, but he was declared not God by his mother. You know, the whole... He was arrested for jewel smuggling, and then she thought it might be better to make somebody else God, so I think his brother was made into God. You know, there was a famous incident where he got pied. You know, what, did they should throw a pie in his face? Yeah, and so somebody accosted him publicly and threw a pie in his face. If he was God, they figured he would be able to stop it. But it didn't work. Anyway, so he was quite a cheater in the modern era. Now, in the previous era, at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, there was a incident. He was at that time the magistrate in Jagannath Puri, and he was also in charge of the Jagannath Temple. And there was a sampradaya called the Atibari Sampradaya, which they followed a person called Jagannath Das. Now, Jagannath Das had originally been a follower of Lord Chaitanya, and Lord Chaitanya had ordered him to follow Haridas Thakur. But he gave that up, and he became a Mayavadi, and he was rejected by Mahaprabhu. So this group, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says about them, he says, this group has many forged books wherein it is written that Chaitanya will again appear. Among them, there are some evil-minded people who attempt to imitate Chaitanya or Brahma, and some who imitate Baladeva or Krishna. One person known as Bhikshakshain, a scoundrel who had developed a little yogic power, was thought to be Mahavishnu himself. So this yogi was claiming to be Mahavishnu. And he established a temple in a jungle near the village of Sharadaipur. And he was exhibiting, and he actually did have mystic power. He was able to cure people from all kinds of diseases and wounds and so forth. So people began to develop quite a lot of faith for him. And then he predicted, they had some kind of concocted scriptures, and in there it was predicted that there would be a battle in March, April of that year, that Mahavishnu would then reveal his forearm form and he would kill all the Europeans and the British, drive the British from India. It had a kind of a political overtone, this whole situation. So they sent out this circular saying that Bhagavan Mahavishnu, who had descended as Bhikshakshain, would deliver India from the hands of the Europeans by killing them all. So he was performing lots of miracles. So people were quite impressed. Sometimes he could read people's minds, apparently, which is one of the siddhis. He could put his head into the fire and leave it there and then take it out again without being injured in any way. So he did a lot of things that really impressed people, and people were frightened of him also because, you know, when someone has mystic power, it seems a bit unearthly. So they thought, well, maybe he really is Mahavishnu. So this matter was brought to the attention of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And generally, you know, it's still to this day, people who are able to gain some mystic power, they generally use it to get a big following and become quite wealthy and get a very good material situation out of it. So it's one of the oldest con games. Get some mystic power, convince people you're God, live a nice, you know, light, opulent life. So he had some associates also. One of them was posing as Brahma and the other as Shiva. So they had all three, Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva. All three were there. So he actually was so good at intimidation that apparently some of the kings of Orissa had sent funds to build his temple and to support his activities. And some of the kings, it says, in villagers even sent women for his pleasure. When he announced he would hold a rasa dance in which he would exhibit his sole supremacy and power over all women. Well, some of the villagers weren't too happy about this because it caused scandal. So they took their complaints to the district commissioner. His name was Ravenshaw. So when he heard about this, he said, this is a sensitive situation because this person has a big following. I mean, they had to be a little careful in those days because they only had a few Britishers were in India, and this person had thousands of followers. So he was afraid that there might be some turmoil, some revolution or something. So so he sent Bhaktivinoda Thakur because he knew that Bhaktivinoda Thakur was a spiritually minded person who knew how to deal with these sort of things. So the Thakur went to see this so-called incarnation, and he went in the evening. And many sick people had come to be cured by this yogi, and they were glorifying him as the incarnation of God. So you can, you know, it's kind of like Bhaktivinoda Thakur walked into a full-blown cult, and all these people were like so reverential to this yogi. So when he arrived, this yogi immediately, when he spotted Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he said, "Oh, Babu, I know that you are a Bengali and a magistrate. Why have you come here on this dark night?" Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur replied, "I've come to see you." Bishop Shane then rejoined, "That being the case, please sit down and hear my teachings. I am Mahavishnu. Arising from the ocean of milk, I have come to this place, and very soon I will destroy all the Europeans, including the King of England. I have proclaimed this everywhere." In his autobiography, the Thakur says, "I went at night to that jungle and spoke at length with Mahavishnu." He doesn't even put it in quotes. He spoke at length with Mahavishnu, and he revealed his vow to destroy the English Raj. So after saying this, Bishop Shane gave Bhaktivinoda Thakur a piece of palm leaf, and everything he just said to him was written on the palm leaf. So, you know, it's quite amazing some of the things he was able to do. He mentioned it in detail, everything about Bhaktivinoda, what his mission was, what his name was, you know, who he was. He seemed to know all about it. But he warned Bhaktivinoda, he said, "Don't interfere with me, otherwise you'll wish you hadn't." But the Thakur was, of course, not very impressed. So he said to him, "If you're Mahavishnu, then why are you staying in this jungle and not at Puri, where Sri Jagannath Dev resides?" The yogi replied haughtily, "I am personally the Supreme Lord. There is no God at Puri. That so-called God Jagannath is merely a big slab of wood. Sri Chaitanya was my beloved devotee, and I will again make India the kingdom of the Hindus. For this reason, I am living in the jungle. I know that you are an excellent court judge and a good devotee as well. When the Hindu kingdom is again established, I will give you a very good position in the government. I will make you the governor of the entire state of Orissa." So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you can imagine, he must have been really trying not to laugh, or at least, but he was quite serious in his response to the yogi. He said, "The tiny living entity can never become God." He said, "Ravana, Hiranyakashipu, Shishupal, Dantavakra, and many others who came under the influence of this arrogant mentality were all destroyed." So then the yogi could see that Bhaktivinoda Thakur wasn't convinced. So then he brought all these people before him that had apparently incurable diseases, and he cured all of them. And then somebody came who was suffering from a spear wound, a deep wound made by a spear. And he rubbed some ashes on it, and the wound disappeared, and the man was completely cured and free of pain. So he was thinking that, you know, this would convince Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So the Thakur, judging that the situation really wasn't quite right yet to make an arrest, he went off, and he went to the other villages nearby to investigate, you know, what the reports were about this yogi. So it says, in some villages he heard praise, but others were angry about the yogi's affairs with married women and were anxious that this fever of attraction to the yogi might spread to the women of their own villages and result in scandal and humiliation. So then He went there with 100 armed policemen back to this camp of the yogi. So most of the followers, when they saw these policemen with their turbans and their weapons, they ran away. So it says they arrived in the early morning hours. A sacrificial fire was burning in front of Vishakshain, and well over 1,000 followers were present. Still, so many were offering prayers to the yogi. So then there was he approached the yogi sitting on his throne, and the yogi says, "Babu, what is the meaning of all this?" asked the yogi with apparent serenity. "They have come to take you. It is the governor's order that you should be brought to Puri," replied the Thakur. The yogi replied harshly, "Who is this governor? I am king, for I am the supreme Godhead and master of all the universe. I bow down before no one. Let us see who is able to take me away from this place. If you do not go peacefully, we will be obliged to take you away by force," replied the Thakur gently. Being enraged, the yogi cried, "I order you to immediately leave this place. Let us see who has the power to take me." Saying this, the yogi shook his head violently, whereupon hundreds and hundreds of fiery flames like burning snakes began to fly out of his matted locks. The yogi's eyes had became bright red, and sparks of fire shot out of them. So he was pretty impressive. I mean, I know, it's fantastic, you know. And the thing is, there's like three or four different biographies about this incident. Writings by I can't remember all the names right now, but so there is a lot of confirmation about these stories. These are actually details that were recorded. So when the police saw this, you know, the fiery sparks and the flames coming out of his head, they were afraid. So they began to fall back. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur still wasn't impressed. "Vishakshain, you may show us as much magic as you like, and we will certainly not forget it. However, you are an offender at the feet of the Supreme Lord. Although you are an insignificant living being, you are proclaiming yourself to be God, but actually you despise God. Furthermore, you are a rebel. You must go to Puri, where you will be judged." The yogi shouted, "I will not go. My power remains. You go away." So then they brought this bullock cart from a village. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur was trying to preach to this to the yogi. He said, "You must give up your deluded mentality and admit your imperfection. Your mystic powers are very insignificant in comparison to the opulences of the Supreme Godhead and the greatness of the Lord's devotees. I request you to correctly understand this just once." The yogi reacted like a trampled snake. "You obviously do not know who I am. If I, just once, ignite the fire of my anger, the three worlds will burn into ashes. But because I am very kind to the universe, I am not doing it." So a good excuse, right? It's like, "I'll show you my universal form, but you don't have the eyes to see." So Bhaktivinoda Thakur began to laugh at this point. "Oh," he said, "Acha, let us now go to Puri. When we get there, you can display the fire of your anger." So they finally arrested him, and he ascended the cart. And he couldn't figure out any way out of it, basically, out of his predicament. So then he kind of came up with this. He said, "It is the word of the devotee that the Supreme Lord protects. Therefore, I am only going to Puri to protect your word, that you would bring me there." So then on the way to Puri, the Thakur was writing up his judgment as to what had happened so far. And as he was writing it up, the yogi was trying to exhibit all these mystic, you know, tricks in the back of the cart, but the Thakur didn't pay much attention to it. Then they put him in solitary confinement. And they had 3 dozen Muslim constables. I guess they figured the Muslims wouldn't be so afraid of him. They had Muslims guarding him. And 72 policemen in charge of guarding his cell day and night. So they were going to make sure he didn't, you know, get away. He then departed to arrest the false Brahma and Shiva, who later pleaded that they had been coerced into their respective roles by Vishakshain. So Bishop Shane, while he was in prison, he refused to take any food or any water. And he didn't sleep the whole time he was in prison. He never slept and he never ate or drank anything. So Bhaktivinoda used to go see him regularly and try to preach to him. But it apparently didn't take. To, you know, just imagine, you have the association of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and you still like, So it's sort of sad in a way. But he gave him lots of good instructions, but he wouldn't listen. His followers managed to get him quite a good lawyer because, you know, they had quite a lot of wealth. So the trial lasted for 18 days. It was held in the district, held in the district court at Puri. Almost, it says, 1,000 of the yogi's followers and sympathizers gathered outside the courthouse during their trial, shouting their demands for the yogi's release. So on the fifth day of the trial, the court was adjourned for the day, and at the completion of the six days' hearings, he threatened the Thakur. He said, "Baba, you must immediately desist from prosecuting me, or everything you have will be destroyed. Go to your home now and see what disaster is taking place there." So when he got there, he found that his daughter, second daughter, she was 7 years old, she had gotten some deadly disease and extremely high fever, and it looked like she might die. She was losing consciousness. And then even his wife became anxious, and she began to plead with Bhaktivinoda Thakur, "Please, maybe we should let him go." And Bhaktivinoda Thakur's response was, "Yes, let us all die," he said, "but this rascal must be punished." So he's pretty staunch. So in his autobiography, he writes this. He says, "All over Puri, there were disturbances. At that time, the Puri school had a fire, and all of the people suspected him. And at this time also, Kadur, a nickname for Kadambini, his daughter, came down with fever. Bishop Shane, by his practice of yoga, had by some means attained yogic powers, and I obtained a lot of evidence against him. For 21 days, he says, he did not eat or drink even a drop of water. But he did not show any weakness and gave unfailing cures to many people. On the 17th day of the trial, when the court rose for recess, Bishop Shane stood up and screamed violently at the Thakur." Well, I'm not going to try to scream. I'll just... "Did you see what great calamity occurred at your house the other day? Still, you are not coming to your senses? When will you be able to recognize me as the Supreme Lord? The final day of my judgment will be your death. What is the punishment for one who disrespects an avatar? How death sits on the seat of judgment and gives out his commands, I will see." So when Bhaktivinoda Thakur got home in the afternoon, he took off his court clothes and he felt a very sharp pain on the right side of his chest. And the pain kept getting worse as the night wore on. And he was unshaken in his determination, but it was unclear how he was going to make it to the court the next morning because he was in so much pain. But it said finally around 10 o'clock, there was somewhat of a subsiding of the pain. And he was ready to write the judgment. He was unable to walk, and he had to be carried in a palanquin into the court. So on that day, it says, 1,000 of the yogi's followers again gathered in front of the courthouse and created a terrific din. Inside, the trial ensued. The Thakur's decision was announced. "Bishop Shane is found guilty of political conspiracy against the National British Indian government as well as the state government of Orissa, and therefore is sentenced to 18 months of strict imprisonment and hard labor." Actually, it wasn't that heavy a sentence, really. 18 months. When the huge crowd outside received the news of Bishop Shane's sentence, they made a tremendous uproar and began to cry in unison, "Injustice! Injustice!" So when he was being led away from the court, there was a district medical officer called Dr. Walters. Now, this is one version. There are several versions of this part of the story. Prabhupada, when he tells this story, says that Bhaktivinoda ordered that his hair be cut. And nobody was willing to do it. All the barbers were afraid. And that then Bhaktivinoda Thakur himself took the scissors and cut off the yogi's hair. Another version of the story is that this district medical officer, Dr. Walters, jumped on him from behind and cut his hair off with a big, large pair of scissors because he had read in books of yoga that this is where the yogis conserve their powers. So as soon as his hair was cut, in any case, they all agreed that his hair was cut off. All the biographers say that his hair was cut off. He fell to the ground, devoid of all power and unable to walk. The pain in the body of the Thakur vanished, and the yogi was removed from the courtroom on a stretcher. When his followers saw that God had been overcome by having his hair removed, most of them deserted him, it says. A lot of people desert us when we cut our hair, right? In the early days in the movement, you cut your hair off, all your friends would go to the other side of the... I had this experience when I joined the movement. I had long hair. I was, you know, kind of one with everybody else. And then when I shaved up and started wearing robes, I remember walking around the town and I'd see some of my old friends and I'd like wave and they would cross the street to the other side just to avoid. Anyway. So, yeah, finished. So he was held in Puri for 3 months and then transferred to the central jail. But it says in 1873, while still in prison, he took poison and died. And then after that, there were several other incarnations that rose up, and all of them were arrested and tried as well. So thus ends the story of... I know that it's a little cinematic, but you know, it's a true story. It happened. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was successful in prosecuting him. But, so, let's get back to the, I mean, I know that was kind of entertaining, I hope, but, huh? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, this exhibiting of effulgence or mystic power, it says here, I'll just reiterate, it is a most sinful activity, Prabhupada says, to attract attention by exhibiting mystic powers and then to utilize this opportunity to declare oneself to be God. A real saintly person never declares himself to be God, but always places himself in the position of a servant of God. For a servant of God, there is no need to exhibit mystic powers, and he does not like to do so, but on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, a humble servant of God performs his activities in such a wonderful way that no common man can dare try to act like him. A saintly person never takes credit for such actions because he knows very well that when wonderful things are done on his behalf by the grace of the Supreme Lord, all credit goes to the master and not to the servant. I think that must be true. You know, I had an experience once of a devotee having mystic power. Well, I think that's what it was. I was sitting in a temple room one time in New York, and I think it was New York. Anyway, we were all seated on the floor, and a few devotees away, Tripurari Swami was sitting there. And I was trying to read the purport in the Bhagavad Gita. And suddenly I felt like something was tugging on my shoulder. And I looked, but there was nobody tugging on my shoulder. So I went back to look at the book. And then I felt it again. And I looked over, and it was Tripurari Maharaj. He was looking at me. And he went like this. And immediately, like I was in a trance, I handed my Bhagavad Gita over to him. Because he wanted to read the purport. I mean, you know, it was like he'd reached out and grabbed me with his eyes. So these powerful devotees, they're empowered to distribute Prabhupada's books. They seem to have that potency that they can, and also they can sometimes speak to people in such a way that people start handing over, you know, piles of money. You know, money is sweeter than honey. I mean, money is like the most important thing in the world to a lot of materialistic people. And, you know, suddenly just to hand over a whole pile of it with books that, you know, that they'd never even thought about reading before. It's quite an interesting phenomenon. Yeah. Hey, why don't you take this over because the Maharaj could be heard. That's all right. Take this one.
I think many devotees had this experience, but I was out one time and I was really, I guess you could say, kind of enthusiastic, and I was just starting to approach one car, and the person rolled down the window, picked out his money from the wallet, and gave it to me even as I was approaching. The it just went like this. Yeah. I said, thank you. He was giving the money before I even got there. So, I mean, devotees do.
I think there must be many such incidents. I got one for you. This one's pretty dramatic. Haridananda Maharaj was out on Sankirtan one time with a bunch of devotees, and this very abusive person came up and was shouting all kinds of blasphemous stuff at the devotees, and they kept trying to move the Sankirtan party along the sidewalk so that he'd just go away, but he kept following them and shouting all this stuff. Finally, Haridananda Maharaj turned to him and said, if you don't stop your behavior, Krishna will kill you. And you know, so then the man was sort of stunned by that, I think, a little bit. I don't know. But anyway, they moved on. They went on through. And then they were kind of working their way back up the street later on, and this person was lying on the ground. He'd had a heart attack and had passed away. So that's sort of scary, isn't it? Now, we're not recommending that you curse anybody, you know, but he wasn't really cursing. He said, Krishna will do something to you if you don't stop it. He was stopped. All right. Hey, there are a lot of stories. So anybody have any questions? Comments? Criticisms? Denunciations? Yeah, okay.
It's in relationship to what you said earlier and how Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, through his humility and his respectability towards the Mayavadis, was actually able to change their heart. Then I was also thinking Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, when he sent his devotees to preach over, you know, outside of India, he said that this is the way to preach to the Westerners. Be very humble, be very tolerant, be very respectful, as opposed to be very shastric and very, you know, overwhelming. Would that work today with the Mayavadis?
I would say that it would probably work in relation to that devotee's purity. In other words, I mean, oftentimes we see that if you behave very humbly, people think you're just foolish. But I think if that person is very pure, I think the super soul within the heart actually instructs those persons if they're sincere. I mean, if it's an insincere person, what can you do? Well, Mayavadis, yeah, I mean, but still at the same time, most people are not very serious Mayavadis anymore. It's mostly just, it, you know, it sounds good. Like, if you have a choice between being the servant of God and being God, I mean, why wouldn't you go for the being God? That sounds a lot more fun. You know, most people, you know, this idea, oh, I'm God, you're God, we're all God. It sounds good, you know. Wow, I can become God. That means I can become the greatest. I don't have to surrender to anybody. I can do whatever I like. That's appealing. But if someone is, you know, got very saintly character and they have any sincerity, then I think it's possible. I mean, on the other hand, how well do, you know, how well will they respond if you just try to lord it over them? So it seems like as devotees, we're just going around looking for that person who will respond to saintly behavior. And then that has to be our modus operandi, I think, in any case. And those who are have some qualification of piety, they'll respond to it. And those who don't are not going to respond to it anyway. That's the way I think.